Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Man there trying to stop Drogba getting himself into further trouble.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
No, don't they just walked away from Huddle then? Valdano, smokes and... Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee.
Een halve finale komen. Ik heb opeens zo'n gevoel dat we in de halve finale gaan komen. Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
So welcome back to the Scoreless Thriller podcast. I'm Alex, as always, and I'm joined by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Very happy to be here with you guys.
And we're delighted to be joined by Sean McCabe. Sean is the world's first football club climate officer at Bose, or Bohemian FC, in Ireland. And yeah, we're delighted to have you on the podcast today, Sean.
Thanks a million, Alex. Nice to be here.
Sean, in addition to his work with Bose, he's executive manager of the TAS, Think Tank for Action and Social Change Centre. He recently published a flagship report, The People's Transition, Community-Led Development for Climate Justice. And before joining TAS, he worked for the Mary Robinson Foundation. So Sean, before we get in, to kind of get this ball rolling a little bit and get this discussion going, I've kind of got to ask the obvious question as to, like, how did this role at Bose come about where they came to you and like, we need a climate officer?
Well, it's kind of interesting, I guess. It didn't really happen. It happened very organically. There was no one coming to anyone else and saying, we need to. It was the result of a few conversations. I think the first was one with Hibernian Football Club in Scotland about 2 years ago, where they had a delegation visiting Dublin. And I'm a member of Bohemian Football Club. Obviously, climate justice and climate action is something I've been working on for the best part of a decade. And so I went along because Hibernian have a great record in doing, they're the greenest club in Scotland, right? And so we went along to learn what they were doing. And that was very interesting. And it was the starting point. Maybe that was the spark that catalyzed everything. But you mentioned just there now, I work with a think tank in Dublin. I run a climate justice center in that think tank. And we published a report, which is a very applied report about how, you know, communities all around the world are facing this massive transition due to the climate crisis. And that report tries to understand how communities aren't just passive passengers in that transition, but actually can own it, can drive it, can be the transition. And so the report was well received. It was called The People's Transition, and it was subsequently funded. We received funding from a bank here in Ireland, AIB, to prototype the model in two locations. So we had one rural, which is in the north of the country in County Donegal, in a place called Ardra, and one in Dublin. And we decided to focus it on Phibsborough because I lived there, and if the lockdowns had persisted, I'd still be able to do the project.
Yeah.
But also because there are some very interesting anchor institutions, which the model that project describes requires. Anchor institutions are like community focal points that allow a community to build from, you know, like it's almost like if you're scaling a mountain and you know when you see those guys free climbing and they're sticking those ratchets in to the cliff face. They're the sort of build, they're like, it's universities, it's hospitals, it's things that are really of the place. And Bohemians Football Club was one of those things, right? So I went and spoke to Bose about the project that was about to kick off, and I left that meeting as, like you say, the world's first climate justice officer. So it was kind of all very serendipitous and very, like, you know, by that evening we were announcing the position and it blew up. I wasn't anticipating it. And Daniel Lambert, the COO of Bose, kind of said, you know, when we do something like this, the response will be significant, because once you start mixing football with another issue, it really, it's a pretty powerful catalyst, you know. And he was right. It really has been.
And what makes Bose special as a football club to kind of choose as a use as a community focal point? Like, what is there something? Do you think there's something unique?
There's something very unique about it. It's fan owned. It's member owned. And this is a critical point. And I think that, you know, the Super League has really shone a light on this stuff over the last fortnight. But we have two options in life in general and how we proceed from this point. Whether it's football or whether it's how we take action on climate change or how we deal with our housing problems that we're encountering all over Europe. Things can either be owned by large companies or they cannot be owned by the people. And that's fundamentally what this comes down to, is that Bohemians is the opposite of those clubs. Not the history of those clubs, but the present of those clubs who are being dragged into that Super League. Because they're fan-owned, they're member-owned, and they give the community a sense of you know, they give the people within our community around Dalyman Park a sense of belonging. They give the members a sense of belonging. And the club draws legitimacy from that. And we saw that, you know, club is, it's in the name. Like, a club is meant to be a thing that's made up of members. And they're not franchises. And so it's actually, as this project and this climate justice initiative of Bose has developed, a broader landscape around, like, you know, the conversation around climate and the conversation around football is also evolving, and this awareness of the opportunities for co-ownership and co-creation and the agency that exists within communities. And this is a really important thing. It's like, if you can own a football club, you can own a wind turbine and, like, share in the power that it generates, or you can own, like, silver pasture business, which is the idea of planting trees on farmland and grazing cattle in between those trees, so you're taking down your emissions. So all of these things can be co-owned, and we're kind of, if we sleepwalk the next 10 years, we'll come to a point where this massive transformation has taken place, and all of the tools of that transformation were privately owned by people similar to those who own those Super League clubs. Or we can be, like, very intentional about it and try very hard and work with government and work with local decision makers to have it end up a little bit more like the Bohemian situation, where you have members owning various aspects of the climate transition. So it's I hope that makes sense. It's a bit esoteric, maybe, or something, but, like, it's actually very important.
It makes complete sense. But I think the Bohemian FC has been member owned since 1890.
That's
And kind of the challenges that we're facing now is, how do we reclaim maybe some clubs or some organizations? And so the question is, within the more recent football history, was there any example of members taking control of a club again to face these social issues and come up with a more community-based approach?
I'm sure there has been. Nothing jumps out. Like, obviously, the German 50+1 system was something that was not, like, it brought in. I think, in the context of the 150-odd years that football has been organized, I think it's relatively recently, right? So, but that required government support, as far as I know, as well. I think expecting it just... There probably has been instances of clubs going into administration and the fans stepping up and saving them. And like, I'm sure there's umpteen instances of that across the leagues. But I think it shouldn't just be up to the fans. I think like the system should be put in place. You know, this, for example, this fan-led review that's being spoken about in the UK right now should be then backed up by government action in order to ensure that these things are you know, because the fans will obviously find that the football club should be fan owned, right? Yeah. Like that's the obvious outcome. But in order then for that to happen, there needs to be the systems and the supports and the legislation in place to enable a transition like that. Because the invisible hand of the market, let's say, won't just allow for that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And isn't it also about our understanding of professional football at the moment? Because if it's about the professionalism that we are experiencing right now, where you have a huge intake of money coming from huge organizations, then surely within this competition, these clubs with that big money will have the better means of getting better players and performing better. And as long as that's the sole focus of the game, it would always be hard for a more community-based club to compete, right?
Well, exactly. That's 100%. Like, it's basically we live in a time of very extractive processes that interact with our lives, and we don't really realize it, right? So football, I think the commercial element of football that like really showed itself badly in the last couple of weeks is a very extractive process. It's about taking money from fans and filtering that money up to either individual owners or shareholders. And that same, you know, like that's we've kind of gotten used to it, right? Like, you know, and to a certain extent, like fans might say that their support and their investment in the club through buying merchandise and all of that enables the club to be a much better, enables them to spend more money and compete on the pitch. But it is also why you get labelled legacy fans, right? Yeah. And it's also why we need these nonsense notions. Like the word, the use of the word did make you sick, but the idea of a solidarity fund for clubs that are going to go into administration because you're going to do irreparable damage to the competition structure that they're a part of. But like the idea that's solidarity, that's a nonsense. Like the very act of leaving is the opposite of solidarity, right? And it's an aggression. And real solidarity, we've kind of lost the sense of it. And I think football clubs, I think if you look at the origins of football and within working communities all across Europe, it's about solidarity. It was at the beginning of the trade union movement. It was when things really were the opposite of what they are now. Or well, actually coming off a slope similar to the one that we're currently rising up, which is like where there was great concentrations of power and wealth, and it was about trying to share that power and wealth out a little bit more and give communities a real sense of belonging and a sense of ownership and a sense of power. And that's, yeah, I think we've seen 30 years of that being eroded, not just here in Ireland, but across Europe. And I think the fans' response, you know, a lot of people have said it's a shame that, and they're right, you know, it's a shame that the same fan response that was mobilized and the fury that was mobilized against the Super League couldn't be done against racism. And then, but then in all other aspects of life, the same thing has to be done. Like, you know, the idea that we import vegetables that are picked by slaves, people who do not get paid for what they're doing, and we eat that in our shops all across Europe. And meanwhile, growers, farmers, people who would be able to promote decent and fair wages in Europe are going out of business. And it's the exact same extractive process. It's just in a different guise. And so I guess what would be lovely to think about as you know, football fans across Europe is how do we take that intensity that went into the resistance of the Super League and put it to fight some of the other very serious issues we're facing. And One of those is climate justice. And this is why the justice piece is important. It's about rectifying injustice. It's not good enough just to save the planet if we don't learn how to take care of people. That's the key point to this.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Like, what's the distinction between you being a climate justice officer as opposed to just climate officer?
Well, it's climate justice is about rectifying injustices. It's about recognizing that we live in an unfair world globally, but also within our towns and cities and our countries, right? That some people have a lot more than others. In Ireland, for example, we have the highest rate of deaths due to excessively cold homes in all of Europe. So more people die just because their homes are cold here than anywhere else in Europe. And that's an embarrassing thing too, but it's also an injustice, right? It's called energy poverty. And, you know, there might be ways that we could, through Bose, through the redevelopment of the stadium, start a conversation about energy poverty, highlight how the, solar panels being used on the stadium, when the stadium isn't in use, can we figure out a way to use that energy that they're generating to address energy poverty in the immediate community? Another example of an injustice that is faced within cities across Europe is that access to green space tends to be much more common in affluent parts of the city, and in poorer parts of the city, generally people are crowded into unfit accommodation, and that also manifests as no green space. So can we work with the council and others? Would people like to work with us in, like, when you buy your season ticket, say you get a tree and that tree gets planted in a forest, which, like, a pocket forest somewhere in the city named after one of the club's legends that starts to address or rebalance that inequity across the city. So it's really I think there's an enormous amount of work, really amazing work being done on sustainability and, you know, clubs reducing their carbon footprint and clubs trying to look at what they're doing with waste. And we are doing that, like, just to say, and I'm learning from what other clubs have done. I'm not, like, you know, I've got a colleague, Stephen Curran, who's helping me out with that. And we're looking through. We're literally trying to learn what other clubs are doing and put that into practice. That's exciting. But then what we're trying to bring to the conversation is this idea that fairness and equity and people should have a voice, and the clubs across the world can be guardians of their communities. They can uplift and give voice to their communities in ways that possibly nothing else can at the minute. And so there's a really exciting role for football clubs and other sports clubs to play in that regard.
Yeah, I read this one interesting quote of yours where you said that back in the days you had these long-lasting institutions of lifelong membership, such as the church or similar structures. But nowadays, football clubs are one of the few institutions that actually still have this membership, and thereby maybe also the possibility to help out over a long extent of time.
Yeah, it's a very, like, you know, over the last 30 years, if you were to put it in a very blunt term, but I think the term turns people off sometimes, we've gone through 30 years of neoliberal economics and neoliberal policies that have guided how our societies have evolved. And so those things have individualized us. They've made people focus highly on their own career. And the concepts like solidarity and community have been put under great stress. And it wasn't by accident, you know, because unions were very powerful things that prevented large business owners from doing exactly what they wanted. And so were, you know, churches in many states, places, religions were these very interesting, like, certainly in the history of Ireland, like the more recent history is very bleak with the church, but in terms of our own revolution, the church would have played a key role in that. And so places where people congregate were put under huge amounts of pressure, except sport, right? Like, but but the ideas of the working class roots and the kind of trade union roots of a lot of football has been slowly sort of brushed over in favor of the glitter and the rouge of things that ultimately end in the Super League. But I think from my perspective, like reclaiming that, but also kind of letting people know that over the last 30 years, it has become cooler to be a consumer than a member of a trade union is a really weird thing. It's like a trick that's been played on society where we've been told, you know, businesses are great and trade unions are the thing not to distrust. You know, like it's a real weird shift that's occurred in consciousness, and it's not unintentional. So football clubs can play a role, not just in that comment. I was kind of saying, like, you know, I'd love to see football clubs in 10 years time not be the only thing that people are lifelong members of. You know, I'd like to see those other, not that I want to see like the church come back, or I want to, you know, but like I'd like to see the idea of community and the idea of belonging and people you know, voting along those lines and governments responding to make sure that the types of there is security, there is the ability to collectively bargain, there is the ability to, you know, join a union. You know, we've seen in the US that incredible situation where the Amazon workers voted against unionizing. And you're like, Christ, how did we get here? You've got this massive corporation that are like literally, you know, pillaging their workers and their customers for all the money that they can possibly get. And yet, there's no, there's somehow the idea of organizing is so scary to people that the workers vote against it.
I've got a question though, because I mean, I absolutely love the idea that you take football kind of as maybe this mirror of society too, where first you had the workers' union, and then throughout the history, the recent history, it got a bit more atomized maybe, and the influence of corporations grew stronger, and it was more made to fit into maybe a capitalist way of exploitation of wealth, of value that is produced. And then the question for me would be now, though, how do you then counteract this? I mean, your idea is to have something community grown, something where there's a lot of solidarity. But a lot of stereotypes of football clubs are exactly the opposite, right? You have local feuds, you have maybe racism, and all of the bad things that are happening also within the fan scene. So how do you assure that this is actually a place where solidarity grow, and where it's not just about, you know, us beating our local opponents the next match, and that's kind of the end of where our ties, you know, form?
Yep. No, I know. It's a really good question. And it is a little bit like society in that term as well. But then you also have to sort of say, like, the divisions are kind of artificial, right? Like, you know, why do you support any individual football club? You know, you go, maybe it's within your family. Maybe it's just a connection.
Yeah, because of my grandma.
Yeah, exactly. But like our society, just like it mirrors society and the divisions, right? Like it also kind of highlights how the divisions are a little bit like unreal in many terms. Like they're not based in anything tangible. They're based in your support for a club. But also then if you look at again what happened with the Super League, like the fans of all stripes united on that one. You know, there was no question about you know, not doing it because you wanted to get one up on your rival club, right? And in terms of climate action, there's something similar there too, right? Like, you know, there's certain things that clubs can do and kind of gloat about. You could have a really nice, you know, there's certain elements of kind of corporate social responsibility that a club could get into, which would look nice and it could be a sort of a unique selling point for your club. But if you're the only club doing good on climate action, it's a waste of time. Like you need everyone to survive the next 10 years. And it is literally that serious. Like we're at such an incredible tipping point. that if we're to survive, if we're to pass on any semblance of a safe and fair world to future generations, then we need everyone doing this. And so one club doing it is, as their unique selling point, would be ridiculous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, we are already working with the European Football for Development Network. Actually, we have a meeting later on today with about 10 clubs. And I don't want to say that. It's not confirmed yet, but it's exciting. It could be to try to take those 10 clubs on a journey of not just sustainability, although that's a core component of a project, but actually trying to look at justice and rallying behind maybe some global campaigns that promote rights and children's rights in particular to a healthy environment, and see where that can guide us and steer us. So, like, there's massive opportunities for clubs to use their leverage and their platforms to overcome the barriers that, you know, like, obviously, like, we don't want it to take the fun out of football if the rivalries went, but those rivalries are about football, they're not about the future of society. And so we can put aside the rivalries when it comes to the very, and we've, like, football fans have shown that in England and across Europe, like, that the rivalries are surface level, like, but what goes deep is solidarity. And that's what we've forgotten about. And that's why the Solidarity Fund is nonsense, right? It's because, like, genuine solidarity is much deeper than that. And caring for your neighbor is a very important element of life. And once you forget about that, you start the spiral that allows you to be exploited. That's the key to it, right? Like, the minute you stop caring about the person next door to you, the minute you stop caring about community, you're ripe for the picking, because it's a divide and conquer sort of situation. So if we can, if football clubs could nurture that sense of care and community and rather than solidarity funds, they'd be very, very powerful.
Whenever Bose announced one of these schemes, like similarly with, like, with your position and also with the refugees welcome shirts, they get it, like, the club gets a lot of good press, but there's also obvious, like, reactionary response, which kind of accused them of quote unquote, like, wokeism, that it's all kind of like just a good branding point for them, right? To have this kind of image of this kind of community club that, like, is kind of countercultural and stuff like this. How do you kind of ensure that it's, like, it's not just kind of empty and it's, like, actually is actually affecting change, and it's not just solely about, like, a kind of a marketing thing for the club?
Well, I think, to be honest, it, like, it's genuine, you know, like, when you team up with Amnesty International and you put refugees welcome on your jersey, you start a conversation that a lot of clubs would shy away from. And you can't get much more genuine than that in that instance. So if it attracts people who share that message, or share the spirit behind that message to the club, and the club benefits financially as a result, that's kind of secondary, if you get me. So, you know, we still in Europe, and these messages are so important to get out there, but, like, Fortress Europe is still such a massive thing. I don't know if you saw the reports last week of Coast Guards towing migrants back into Turkish waters and leaving them there. This is happening on our borders, and it's murder. Like, you don't get much worse than these sort of instances. So, what can we do as a football club? Well, we can highlight some of those issues and hope that people pay attention. In terms of, you know, we've just recently appointed an inclusion officer at the club, and he's doing unbelievable work in terms of bringing together fans who maybe have different needs when it comes to how to access the stadium, how to engage with their membership. And it's just a case of listening to what they want and need and trying to address that, both with the current Daily Mount and with the redevelopment. Then, you know, we've got walking football for elderly people. We've got obviously started with a significant women's team now, and so, like, is there an element to this that is like it makes the club successful? The ground is packed now, and not all League of Ireland grounds are every match, right? But is it just because it's woke nonsense, or is it because it resonates with people and they come? And are the people who are slinging accusations of being woke, like, you know, have they even explored what the term woke means? Like, it's got nothing to do with people in Ireland. Like, it's a black movement in the US about women's rights. So, like, you know, we're the whole thing. Twitter is just an awful place, and it's easy to start kind of slinging accusations. And there is an element of you know, you don't want to be preaching at people, but I don't think that's what we're trying to do. Like, I think if I was here telling you that the world was coming to an end and everyone had to pull up their socks and get on with recycling, and, you know, that'd be a message that maybe you could accuse me of being woke, because it actually puts no responsibility on me. It's just I dish it out to people. Whereas I think what we're trying to do is take on a very challenging conversation about, well, how can communities benefit from the transition that we're about to go through, and how do football clubs play that role? And to be honest, there's nothing woke about that. There's nothing woke about caring about making sure that your community stays a prosperous place and that people are cared for. And, you know, nobody accused Marcus Rashford of being woke. And that's an important point. Like, he was dealing with a very serious social issue. Imagine accusing him of being woke for trying to feed hungry children. You know, these are very serious, deeply entrenched issues. And if people aren't recognizing the seriousness of them, the confluence of inequality and climate action is enormous. And if you think it's woke to talk about it, you haven't taught enough about what it means. You haven't taught enough about how you personally and individually could lose out, and you haven't taught enough about how your family and your community could lose out as a result of those two things colliding in a way where people haven't been talking about them, or haven't been exploring them, or raising the voices of community. So, I think, look, it's a little bit of a rant there. I really believe that, some of the stuff that we get in response is mostly banter. We get a lot of slagging. I think people identify underneath all of that. There's something sincere.
There's also like tied into kind of a club rivalry thing, right? So that people want.
Yeah, of course. It's kind of what we were talking about just a moment ago, where we there is that element of ribbing. But then as things go on and as we make announcements, and there's a lot more to come in the coming weeks and months, you do see the people being like, fair play, they're actually moving. And on this issue in particular, we don't want this to be just a Bose thing. We want people to come on this journey with us, because we want other clubs, we want football associations, we want everyone involved in this. Because if we could mobilize world football behind climate justice specifically, we could do something really great.
And I feel like in this endeavor, some healthy amount of skepticism and maybe even criticism is very important, right? Because there have been so many instances of greenwashing of companies, of clubs, of everything, that of course, you know, you should double check, is this a genuine approach to make things better? Or, you know, is it just something shiny that you can put on your shirts or whatever and then be happy about it?
100%. 100%. And I think one of the, like, the, you know, we don't get away with greenwashing in this decade. You know, like, this isn't something that I can stand here and say all sorts of stuff about how we need to make the transition and then do nothing and expect that in 10 years' time you guys can't come back to me and say, what was that nonsense? You know, like, it'll have a direct impact on my future career prospects if we don't do something. I think you're dead right. I think it is really, really important that we interrogate what people are saying. We interrogate the commitments that are being made, not just by, like, football clubs should be interrogated, but really governments. That would be the first place to start with who we interrogate. And then large corporations, like, if are they doing what they say they're doing, or are they trying to pull the wool over our eyes? And then football clubs. But yeah, absolutely. I think everyone should be like, and that's part of, I guess that's part of the project we're discussing with the European Football Development Network, is how do we put in place the metrics and the scoring systems to understand whether the steps that are being taken are working.
And how to start the conversation, right? And I feel like their football may be a very good vehicle because it might open up new audiences to topics such as climate change, such as migration, that are not part of this, to not use Vogue, but like very academic, maybe leftist sphere that talk about these issues maybe more than others. And so I think it might be very, very important.
Yeah, completely. Like, for example, we're actually having a conversation with Barcelona in about an hour, and they have 350 million followers. Yeah. Like, that's a significant percentage of the world's population. It's not even like, you know, like that's a large amount of the world's population. So if they were, and they already do great work with UNICEF and highlighting children's rights issues, and, you know, like, so that type of thing is enormous. And if we had the whole football sphere moving in similar lines, yes, absolutely, it is the best vehicle imaginable for these conversations. Loads of people spend a lot more time reading the back pages than the front pages, including myself, actually, for most of them.
Well, we won't keep Barcelona on the line waiting too long. But if people are interested in kind of finding out more about what Bose are doing with you and climate and also community-led, how can they kind of, if they want to find out more information, or maybe they're abroad and like follow the club, where would be the best place to look?
Well, the Bose website is always a good starting place. That's just bohemianfc.com. There's my Twitter, seems to have at least as much about Bose as my work at this point in time. So that's Sean McCauba, I think. Maybe you could include it. I can't really remember what my own.
I'll put it in the description.
But you can also reach out to me directly at. Let me just figure out what that email is. I'm great at these things, obviously. As you can see, I'm
prepared with your press release.
Yeah, yeah. I've no idea what it's climate officer at bohemianfc.com, okay. I think, but you might just confirm that.
Will do. Sounds professional.
Oh, wait, no, here it is. That does, yeah. No, it's all very. No, actually, it's climate officer at bohemians.ie. Okay. So yeah, like, do reach out if anyone has any ideas or thoughts or wants to share anything. We're busy. It's a voluntary position. That's an important thing to stress. So we're doing what we can, and trying to get back to people as we can. So if you don't hear from us, it doesn't mean that we didn't appreciate your inquiry. It just means that we're a little bit snowed on.
And what has been the response from other clubs when you've been trying to reach out? Has it kind of spread quickly? Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. People are very keen to engage. Like, in fact, I'm struggling to keep up. So it's good. It's really, really positive.
All right, Sean. Really thank positive. You so much for joining us on the podcast.
Hi, guys. It was a pleasure chatting.
Yeah. And thanks for your work. I think it's incredibly important. And lovely to see you.
I appreciate that. Well, hopefully, like you say, hopefully it will work, and hopefully it strikes something genuine. Yeah. Because I think the authenticity of everything is what is the measure of it. So we'll endeavor to do that.
All right, Sean. Have a good Friday.
Fantastic.
Nice one, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Take care of yourselves.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Social Podcast Network.